lifting all the loads. Granite stuck to their fingers as they built the canals and the roads. Now they're cleared and the bridges span. Rivers pause by a power dam.
Pacifica Radio Network's special labor coverage of the blockbuster events surrounding the AFL-CIO at its 25th Constitutional Convention in Chicago. This report is coming to you from the studio of WBAI Radio in New York and is produced by Building Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Mimi Rosenberg with Ken Nash on assignment in Chicago. Two giant unions, the Teamsters and the Service Employees International Union, have withdrawn from the previously 56-member labor federation, the AFL-CIO. Unite Here and the United Food and Commercial Workers boycotted the Constitutional Convention, and the Laborers Union and the Farm Workers recently joined the insurgent coalition Change to Win, while the Carpenters, who also joined the coalition, had left the federation some time ago. This is, of course, a major development within the organized labor movement. But is the split merely rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic as the ranks of organized labor continue to shrink? We'll hear voices on both sides of the debate, independent commentators, analysis of the current crisis in labor, and discuss where's the voice of the rank and file, and how are they to be mobilized to affect their class interest. Joining us now is Dr. David Montgomery. Dr. Montgomery was president of the Organization of American Historians. He worked as a machinist and was an active union member. He is the author of numerous books which deal with the history and current prospects of working in the United States. His last book was Black Workers' Struggles for Equality in Birmingham, based on oral histories of people of African ancestry who made use of a variety of different kinds of unions in their quest for equality. Let's lift the title from one of Professor Montgomery's best-known books, The Fall of the House of Labor, The Workplace, The State, The American Labor Activism, to prelude the development of and contextualize the breakup of the AFL-CIO. I want to welcome Ken Nash from Chicago. Hi, Ken.
Amy, how are you doing?
Very good. Of course, Professor Montgomery.
Hi, Amy.
Let's begin, Professor. Some have compared the split by the Change to Win coalition unions as reminiscent of the Congress of Industrial Organizations, the CIO. Is that an accurate and meaningful comparison?
Well, I think there are very different circumstances. One may hope for some similar results, but the circumstances are very different indeed. First of all, when the CIO was formed in 1935, the unions who formed it did not want to leave the AFL. Over the next 2 years, one after another, they were thrown out. But it was to be an organization to develop industrial unionism inside the AFL itself originally. Secondly, it was formed in the context of huge struggles by workers to unionize all around the country. Almost as soon as the CIO had been formed, its president, John L. Lewis, went first to Akron, where the whole city was on strike, all the rubber workers there, and told them why the CIO was important to their cause. Then to Cleveland, where this was early 1936, to Cleveland, where auto workers was on strike. In other words, there was the action going on all around when the CIO was formed, as the phrase often has gone, workers were simply knocking on laborers' door to get in. And third, there was a very, very different political environment. The Wagner Act had just been passed, opening the way to unionization in mass production industries, and the Wagner Act today has, in the unforgettable words of David Brody, been hijacked by its enemies. It's essentially an employer's instrument. So this is a very different context we're in today.
Dr. Montgomery, can we talk about the merger now
yep.
in 1955
yep.
And what effect that had on unions? And I mean, the split was surrounded by union growth and continued during the split,
mm-hmm.
and the merger seemed to be surrounded by union stagnation.
Yeah, the peak of union growth came just before the merger, about 1953, and the growth in the proportion of workers unionized had gone on up to that point. I can remember working as a machinist in 1955 and sensing great excitement among workers that the merger, faced with what they considered the hostile government of President Eisenhower, could lead to a revival of the union movement. But precious little revival came out of it after the merger itself sort of settled down. In fact, if you want an unfortunate example of a split from the AFL-CIO, I think of 1969 when the United Auto Workers left the AFL-CIO because it wasn't getting anywhere and formed the Alliance for Labor Action in conjunction with the Teamsters. That alliance organized one aircraft factory in Georgia, and that was it, and then went out of existence in 1972. So this is the pessimistic side of the story.
Professor Montgomery, from the perspective of organizing, what was the significance of the development of capital in the earlier periods of the 30s, et cetera, and the response to it by the working class as differentiated from the period of time that we're in now?
Yeah. Several major differences. First of all, the United States had emerged as easily the leading industrial power of the world. And indeed, after World War II, well over half of the manufactured goods of the entire world were produced here in the United States. So that here was the country which was then the heartland of manufacturing. Secondly, immigration had been shut down. And for the only time in American history, between the late 1920s and the 1950s, there was precious little immigration into this country. And the working class consisted primarily of children of immigrants who'd all gone to school together and spoke English and could easily feel a common sense then in the, a sense of common interest there in the 1930s. And secondly, in the context of the Depression, those very children of the immigrants had been the decisive voters in putting into power a New Deal government that wanted to have economic planning for the domestic market, and that also saw in this the need for a union movement to see to it that there was the purchasing power to keep that market going. So it was a very different thing from what they call the neoliberalism of today, the absolutely free market economics of the Bush days.
In terms of what you're saying, is the significance what's happening at the top at the AFL-CIO level, or what's happening with the workers themselves and their organizations and the activism of the working class itself, and the rest just a reflection of that?
Yeah, I think it's something of both. There's no question, but at the top, there is a very clear sense that the labor movement has been declining in numbers and influence for a good many years, and clearly this Change to Win coalition argues that we have to do something to break out of that long-term decline we've been in. But the among the workers themselves, there have been some very significant differences. First of all, I think there's, well, put it this way. When the unions burst into strength in the 1930s, in almost every factory of America, there were a lot of workers who had had the experience of the union growth of 1916, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22. It had only been 10 years since the last great burst of union activity. And this meant that there were everywhere working people with a sense of how to organize and that they wanted to organize. They'd been smashed flat in the 1920s, but they're ready to go again. Today, I think as much as it is, except for one thing, and that comes with the reopening of immigration. It's remarkable how many of the leading activists of the unions in the Change to Win coalition are immigrants themselves. This has happened again and again in American history, immigrants revitalizing the American labor movement. But a lot of these people are highly experienced politically, and I think are going to play a crucial role in unionizing in the future.
I want to actually borrow another piece of your book title, this one going back to Black Workers' Struggles for Equality in Birmingham. And the book deals with precisely the variety of different kinds of unions that people of African ancestry joined for their quest for equality. Now, just looking at where we are today, where the debate seems rather stiltified, whether or not you're looking at the AFL-CIO proper or at this time, the Change to Win coalition, what is it that isn't being discussed about the way people organize and become organized and mobilized to represent their class interests?
Mm-hmm. I think there is all too little interest today, to put it mildly, all too little interest in the way in which rank-and-file working people themselves form the networks. The basic theme that I argue in that book, Black Workers' Struggle for Equality in Birmingham, is that with all this variety of unions, and many of them white supremacist unions, the black workers there formed networks of their own that linked together. They would meet on Sunday or on an evening and talk about their common problems, study contracts, know the law, and know what was going on, and bring back what they were doing into their organizations. I think this is what really needs to be revived today. There is no way you're going to get, I think, a resurgence of union organizations strictly from the top.
You seem to also be saying not only strictly from the top, but what has to be integrated in is looking holistically at the person. There's a way to relate to your workplace, but we have issues of gender, of sexual orientation. We have the core of our identity. All these things seem to be ignored. The union movement kind of bifurcates and tears us and makes us. It takes a very economist view of organizing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think in recent years there has been a good deal of lip service to organizing on all of these fronts. But to bring a revival of union activity, one has to remember, as one of the Birmingham leaders once put it, that when people came pouring into the union movement, they didn't come as individuals, they came in groups. And we know that there was this gathering of people around this church with this orientation of that particular ethnic background. They were the ones that came together into the organization. And that was certainly the case through the 1930s. Again, what a union like the service employees emphasizes, and a hotel and restaurant, is that they have managed to make links in many parts of the country with especially recent immigrants along all of these issues. And that's what they're claiming. They want a chance to follow up.
One of the get into the relation of politics and organizing, the FL-CIO is pushing very hard for the Employee Choice Act, which would reform the labor laws. Now, the question is, in terms of the Wagner Act, did the Wagner Act cause the unionization in the 30s, or did the unionization in the 30s cause the Wagner Act?
Some of both. Primarily, the Wagner Act was passed because unionizing was going on, and Senator Wagner is perfectly blunt about it. He said that the greatest number of strikes in the country was caused by attempts to get unions recognized. So if we could find a way to get unions recognized without strikes, then recovery would come more easily. So in that sense, the Wagner Act was caused by the militancy of the workers that was then going on. But on the other side, it opened all kinds of hopes. I used to live in the Pittsburgh area, and to this day, the story of Aliquippa carries on. In the little steel strike of 1937, which was largely a defeat for the CIO, except in Jones and Lachlan. At the Jones and Lachlan mill in Aliquippa, the NLRB had reinstated some 116 workers who'd been fired for union activity. And they all marched down the street together with brass bands and went into their jobs. And it was that kicked off the sense of strength among everybody and was decisive in shutting down that mill completely and helping to win the strike. So there's some of both is the case.
Well, we have just a moment left. Was it unfortunate that there was a boycott by the laborers, by the farm workers, indeed even a split before the convention really began of the Change to Win coalition?
Yeah, I think it was unfortunate. I think a great deal was possible from the inside. But I think the greatest danger at this point is an angry counter-reaction inside the unions that stayed with the AFL-CIO. You get a speech like Linda Chavez Thompson in which she equates the coalition, the Change to Win coalition. She says they're just like the Right to Work organization and the Chamber of Commerce. They are enemies of the labor movement. I think that's the worst possible attitude at this point. And I think the leaders of the communication workers have really been leading the way to open things up. And indeed, one final thing to note, it was they who made possible today the adoption of the resolution calling for withdrawal from Iraq.
And we are going to take another look at the extraordinary resolution. I almost said revolution, and in a way it is, because 50 years of Cold War policy and support of U.S. militarization, it's quite remarkable that they do have a resolution that says rapidly bring the troops home and was defined from the podium as meaning now. Well, Dr. Montgomery, we thank you for being with us, and I do encourage our listeners to, if they haven't already, they really should avail themselves of your books. They are most important and give a context to what we're going through today. Thank you very much for joining us this Labor Special.
Let me tell you what to do. You got to talk to the workers in the shop with you. Got to build you a union, got to make it strong. But if you all stick together, it won't be long. You get shorter hours, better working conditions, vacations with pay. Yo, take your kids to the seashore, man. It ain't quite that simple, so I better explain just why you got to ride on the union train. If you wait for the boss to raise your pay, you'll all be waiting till judgment day. All preparing. Gone to heaven. St. Peter be the straw boss then. Now, you know you're underpaid, but the boss says you ain't. Speeds up the work till you're about to faint. Maybe down and out, but you ain't beaten. You can pass out and leave and even call a meeting. Talk it over. Speak your mind. Decide to do something about it.
First, the boss may persuade some poor damn fool to go to your meet and act like a school. But you can always tell a school that's a fact. He's got a yellow streak running down his back. He doesn't have to stool. He'll always get along on what he takes out of
blind man's cups.
You know that. You know that.
That's right.
Now, amidst what has been the cloistered debate of organized labor's hierarchy, Ken Nash brings us the voices of rank-and-file workers Marilyn Stewart, president of the Chicago Teachers Union, Sarah Dela Cruz with the Association of Flight Attendants, United Airlines, and Sue Ann Gonzalez, a registered nurse.
Good afternoon. My name is Sulema Gonzalez. I work as a registered nurse at St. Mary of Nazareth Hospital here in Chicago. St. Mary's is one of 9 hospitals in the Resurrection Healthcare System, Illinois' largest Catholic healthcare provider. I have been a registered nurse for 11 years. My interest began when I was a little girl, and I would accompany my parents, who only spoke Spanish, to their doctor visits to translate. I was fascinated. I've always loved taking care of people. And I see my role as a nurse to provide quality clinical care, but also to comfort the sick and needy. When I first started working at St. Mary's, I attended to patients' physical and emotional needs. But since our hospital was bought by Resurrection, all that matters is the bottom line. Even with a severe nurse shortage right now, Resurrection has a policy where if you get sick more than 3 times per year, you're disciplined. Earlier this year, they combined our sick time and our vacation time, thus cutting into our vacation time. Is this any way to encourage retention and high morale? No. We decided that Resurrection would never listen to our concerns if we weren't organized. So over 2 years ago, my coworkers and I decided to form a union with AFSCME Council 31. We are nurses who can't provide the type of care we were trained to provide because we're understaffed. We're nurses aides who end our shifts exhausted, tired from running room to room, never able to sit down with patients and comfort them when they're at their most vulnerable. We're housekeepers and food service workers who are paid poverty wages, even though our CEO made more than $2 million last year. Yeah. We're building a union because Resurrection can do better for its patients and its workers. Catholic social teachings support the right of workers to organize, but what has Resurrection done? They fought us. They sent out letters telling us not to talk to union organizers. They held captive audience meetings to persuade our co-workers that we don't need a union. They even fired 9 union supporters. Right now, my co-workers are very scared. But we have not backed down. We've talked to dozens of Chicago priests who have told Resurrection management that it's not Christian to intimidate employees. We've reached out to members of AFSCME and other unions for support. We've built a coalition of community groups that consistently answer our calls for help. We need a fair organizing process. We want change, and we will win because we are right.
That's right. That's right.
We are committed, and because our brothers and sisters in the labor movement and the good people in our communities are supporting us. I look forward to the day I can go to an AFL-CIO convention as a proud member of AFSCME Council 31, and I'll be ready to do whatever it takes to help the next group of struggling workers win a voice at work. Si nos mantenemos unidos, nunca seremos vencidos.
That's right.
Thank you.
Please join me in welcoming AFT Chicago's Teachers Union President, Marilyn Stewart.
First, let me start by saying to all of our friends from out of town, on behalf of the 37,000 members of the Chicago Teachers Union, welcome to Chicago! Chicago's had a long history of being a union town. If the American labor movement was a building, Chicago would be its foundation. Now is not to change all that. When we talk about educating the leaders for tomorrow in the Chicago public schools, we need to keep those schools public. As a teachers union, we are constantly fighting unguided policies and misguided or anti-union initiatives such as privatization of our schools. Privatization of our schools displaces children, silences the voices of parents, and removes highly qualified and dedicated teachers from the classroom. Labor needs a strong, united voice to stop policies that are not in the best interest of our children. We need a strong, united voice to keep big business out of the classrooms when they have no experience or interest other than a profit in educating our children. We need to educate parents and the general public on the damaging path privatization will take. We will be doing just that by co-hosting an education explosion on September 8th. We will educate and highlight the issues of privatizing our schools. I want to thank the union workers who put this rally together, and I want to thank my members of the Chicago Teachers Union for joining me in this Solidarity Day. We need to be united. We need to have a united front, a united voice, nothing less. Remember, united we stand, divided we fall. Thank you very much.
Now I'd like you to join me in giving a warm welcome to a sister on the battlefield, Sarah Dela Cruz, a United Airlines flight attendant.
They stole it. I gave United Airlines 10 years of my life, and they stole my pension. My airline suffered, so I sacrificed my pay. I work longer days, I pay more for my medical, and they stole my pension. Why should I have a pension? Someone far more intelligent and passionate than me broke through the accepted norms and convinced other stewardesses that we should form a union. So we wouldn't have to quit at age 32, so we could be married and have families. So we wouldn't have to step on a weight scale when we checked into work. So we could be respected as safety professionals, and we could bargain to build a flight attendant career with a pension. We bargained. We gave up pay to have a pension. We signed a contract. We held up our end of the deal, and they stole our pension. Who are they? They are the same people who made the bad decisions that ushered United Airlines into bankruptcy. They are led by CEO Glenn Tilton, a two-year employee of my airline, whose $4.5 million pension trust remains untouched. Unquestioned by the court, unquestioned by this administration, and bolstered by our boardroom full of executive bullies from Steel and other companies who have the proud tradition of stealing their employees' pensions. Corporate greed has its own unions, brothers and sisters, and they want labor to pay their dues. We're not going to pay their dues. We are not going to sit at the back of the bus. We are not going to quit when we turn 32. And we are not going to accept that our pensions are gone. We are fighting for our pensions in court. We're fighting for pensions on Capitol Hill. And if we have to strike, we'll fight with chaos. Our chaos campaign will hit the airports hard on Thursday with flight attendant demonstrations in over 20 cities around the world. And together with workers like you who won't accept that pensions are a thing of the past, we will save our pensions. And we appreciate your support. Corporate crooks want to divide us. They want free rein to rip up our contracts, steal our pensions, and fatten their own wallets. But this is a nation where the people have the power. So let's stand together and use it. Ain't gonna let nobody turn us around.
Como somos hermanos, la alegría compartimos con todos los campesinos. ¡Viva la revolución! ¡Viva nuestra asociación! ¡Viva huelga en general! El 18 de septiembre, de los campos de Belén salieron los filipinos. Y después de dos semanas, para unirse a la batalla, salieron los mexicanos. Juntos vamos cumpliendo con la marcha de la historia para liberar
el pueblo. Viva la revolución, viva nuestra asociación, viva huelga general, viva la huelga en el fin.
Against the strains of talking about a general strike, you're listening to the Pacifica Radio Network's special labor coverage of the blockbuster events surrounding the AFL-CIO at its constitutional convention in Chicago. This report is coming to you from the studio of WBAI Radio in New York and is produced by Building Bridges, Your Community and Labor Report, with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash on assignment in Chicago. Now, the perspective of AFL-CIO Executive Vice President Linda Chavez-Thompson on the split in the Federation.
As we are gathered here today, we're sending the world a message. The unions and the union members of the AFL-CIO stand together, fight together, and no one can tear us apart. No one. That doesn't mean they're not going to try. There are those who are trying to divide us and conquer us and to prevent us from speaking up for working families. Who are they? They are the Chamber of Commerce. They are the National Association of Manufacturers. The National Right to Work Committee. George W. Bush. Walmart. And the Change to Win Coalition. We've come a long way. Not so long ago, a woman's place in her union was behind a typewriter. Today, a brown woman's place is in her union, on the picket line, in the offices, organizing, wherever we need to be. When John Sweeney was elected president of the AFL-CIO, he promised to change this labor movement. Today, we have more women and people of color on our executive council. We have more diversity at every level. And sisters and brothers, I am living proof that John Sweeney believes, as we all believe, that a woman's place, a Latina's place, is at the absolute top of this American labor movement. Sisters and brothers, we fought like hell to get to where we are, to set our union movement free, to open the doors so that every worker, every member could come in and have a seat at the table. Now that is threatened by leaders who want to turn back the clock, who want to tell us what we should do and where we should be. They want to rule top down. Well, it's not happening. Never has it been more important to have a democratic, united labor movement, one where everybody has a voice and where we move forward together. That's what we're all about this week and for the rest of the time that you give us as far as heading this great labor movement of ours. That's what working people deserve. And sisters and brothers, let me assure you, I am prepared as I am with President Sweeney and Richard Trumka, and we will do the best that we can for each and every one of you. Thank you so much.
Well, that was Linda Chavez-Thompson, executive board member of Unite Here and treasurer of the Change to Win Coalition. Edgar Romney joins us, and it is always good to talk with you, Edgar.
Hi, how are you?
It's good. We go way back to the International Ladies Garment Workers Union.
That's a long time ago.
It is indeed.
Edgar, you heard Linda Chavez-Thompson. There's a lot of anger within the Federation right now about the withdrawal of two unions and the boycott by four others of the proceedings of the AFL-CIO. There's also questions as to whether it was necessary. Hasn't the Federation changed a lot in response to the demands of the change of the coalition to win? They've instituted rebates. They've changed their procedures with regard to jurisdiction. They've gone a long way. Was it really necessary to bolt the convention and disaffiliate?
Well, first let me say, in reference to Linda Chavez-Thompson's comments and comparing us to Walmart, I've known Linda Chavez Thompson for many, many years, and I have the utmost respect and regard for her contribution to working people in this country. And I'm a little surprised and taken back that she would compare us to Walmart and the Chamber of Commerce and the Bush administration because of the fact that we have a difference of opinion as to the future and the strategy in terms of the labor movement. We certainly can respect each other's rights, and we should, and we can certainly disagree without being disagreeable. I think the issue here is the fact that the labor movement has been somewhat stagnant in the last number of years. The Change to Win coalition and unions, the seven unions that now make up that coalition, feel very strongly that there's a new direction that's needed for workers in this country. We all know the horrible numbers in terms of the loss of jobs and the loss of many industries in this country. The fact that the labor movement now is the private sector particularly is only represented by 8% of only 8% of the workers are represented. We feel strongly that a new direction is needed for workers. And if we're going to be successful, that we have to develop a much, much different strategy and tact than what we have done in the past.
The unions are still losing membership. What's the next step for the coalition, the Change to Win? How does it intend to stem the tide? What can it do differently than the unions that stayed with the Federation?
Well, firstly, I think that we have to come together and put the necessary resources in terms of organizing. You may be aware that one of the issues in this discussion and debate, if I may, was the amount that unions that were actively organizing would get back in the form of rebates so that they can go out and organize. It's unfortunate that many of the unions in this country have just given up because it is hard and it is difficult, but that's not the way to resolve a problem. Partly the AFL-CIO, I think, attempted to change the dynamic by putting a lot of resources into politicians, and hopefully that might problem might be solved through a legislative process. But as we've learned in the last two elections, that's certainly not going to happen. What the Change the Wind Coalition is going to do in terms of changing the face of the labor movement in this country is going to focus on organizing industries. We're going to come together in a way that unions have not come together before and to work very, very closely together. Because what we realize that no one union, as powerful as some of the unions in this coalition, which all of them have certainly have an organizing culture, but no one union is going to be able to do this job by ourselves. For example, some of these activities have already started. You may be aware of a major laundry campaign that's going on between the Teamsters and Unite Here against the Cintox Corporation. I mean, here's a company, the largest laundry company in North America that employs some 20,000 people. What we've done is come together some time ago and to begin to put together a strategy to organize these workers, and we certainly will be successful. What we're going to have to do is to bring together the best minds in the coalition to be able to organize workers in industries and work very, very closely together.
The concern of a lot of delegates at the convention on the local level is with regard to what this will do with labor cooperation at that level in cities, towns, and states, what will happen to the Central Labor Council, and also whether this will presage a new age of rating of warfare between the unions. What's your opinion? What's the opinion of the Change to Win Coalition?
Well, I think that I serve on both the New York City Central Labor Council as well as the New York State FFL-CIO. And it is our intention, and certainly mine as a officer of both of those groups, to continue to do several things. One, the Change to Win Coalition intends to pay per capita to the state and local feds all around the country. We also want to be active and continue to participate on the local level if they, in fact, will have us. If that does not work, it will be because the AFL-CIO decided that they're not going to allow us to participate. That certainly will have some effect on the state and local level because we've in many, many areas around the country, have found ways on the state and local level, you know, to work together. And so I certainly hope and that this kind of level of cooperation and activity will be able to continue on the state and local levels.
The only union really among the Change to Win coalition that has significantly increased its size seems to have been SEIU. What will Change to Win bring to the organizing process that is different than the unions that they are critical of?
Well, I think one of the things that we're going to do is to use the model of SEIU. They have found a winning strategy, if I may, because during the last 10 years they've organized over 900,000 members. We want to work very, very closely with them and use the resources of their capital strategies, of their researchers, and even some of their organizers, and put them together with organizers from the Teamsters, from Unite here, from UFCW, to really begin to work together in an environment that has not done before. SEIU has extraordinary capacity for research and capital strategies. One of the things that we're going to be able to do now that for whatever reason did not happen before is really to develop this level of cooperation. We're going to be seven unions, but one goal and one vision and one strategy. And from somebody who's been in labor movement for some 40 years, I've never seen that kind of I've never experienced that kind of level of cooperation between a labor movement before. So I think that there's a lot of reason to be hopeful and certainly optimistic in terms of us being able to organize hundreds of thousands of workers in the next number of years.
So far, two unions have disaffiliated, Service Employees Union and the Teamsters. What will happen with Unite here? What will happen with United Food and Commercial Workers Union and the other unions who are members of Change to Win?
Well, Unite here and the United Food and Commercial Workers are currently looking at what their own situations are. I can speak for Unite here. We have a process that we are currently going through. We have met with our executive committee of the executive board of Unite here, and we will be having further discussions with the entire board of Unite here. And it's a process. I don't know exactly what will happen or when it will happen, but I can assure you that Unite Here, UFCW, and the other unions in the coalition are going through a similar process.
I want to press even further on looking at issues such as privatization and the globalization of the workforce. They're clearly significant issues. How does the coalition see organizing around these issues, really tackling this? And it's so hard to win economic strikes these days.
Well, you know, I come out of an industry that, out of the apparel and textile industry, which has lost over 70% of that industry in the last number of years. I think had the labor movement been stronger than what we have been in the past number of years, first, we certainly would have been able to slow down the exportation of jobs. One of the things that the coalition, to Change to Win coalition is going to do is to focus on what industries that we're going to have a great deal of success in organizing. We know, for example, in following the lead of SEIU, janitors and service people, hospital workers, okay, that work in jobs that are not going to be able to be moved overseas. In my own particular union, Unite Here, and we've been concentrating on laundries, and since we've merged with Hotel and Restaurant Workers Union, we will be focused on hotels, gaming industry, which is growing in large measure, particularly Indian gaming in states like New York and California and other gaming industries around the country. We will also be looking to organize workers in geographical areas of the country, particularly immigrant workers, those workers who perhaps need representation more than most. We'll also be looking and focusing on African-American workers in the South and industries in that part of the country where we might have some opportunity to organize. So we're going to do this on a large scale. We're going to bring the best minds of organizers of these seven unions and perhaps even other unions that might want to join us as a result of what they see that we are doing. So I'm very excited and very challenged at the opportunities that we're being presented with here.
Change to the AFL-CIO, we just adopted a very significant new position on the war in Iraq. Does Change to Win plan to issue a statement on this question of withdrawal from Iraq?
Well, I think many of the unions, if not most of the unions, went against the war at the outset. We have not discussed that yet, and I did see that they did take a position on that. I think that's certainly the right position. I'm pleased to see that. And one of the things that I think that's going to happen is that you're going to see a lot of things, you know, that Change the Wind Coalition and the AFL-CIO, like this particular issue, certainly could work very, very closely with. And we're hopeful that we're going to be able to do that in the future. But I would suspect that we will be discussing this issue in the next day or two and issuing a statement as well.
And we've been speaking with Executive Board Member of Unite Here and Treasurer of the Change to Win Coalition, Edgar Romney. Thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Well, now we're going to hear the point of view of Anna Berger, Chair of the Change to Win Coalition, at the press conference announcing the boycott of the convention.
Today we say that workers are going to take back our country. The time has come for big ideas and bold thinking. Today will be remembered as the rebirth of the union strength in America. Workers desperately need that rebirth. The America dream is out of reach for increasing numbers of families in this country. The exciting news is that the Change to Win Coalition is about one thing. New hope for millions of workers in economic crisis. All of organized labor sees the crisis. Our coalition, however, believes that we can do something about it and has a bold plan of action to make real change. We will provide focus, strategy, and the resources to help workers achieve economic security that they so richly deserve. This debate began with the desire to reform the AFL-CIO. It has evolved into an exciting new movement to organize and unite workers across America and around our globe. Over the past 9 months, every corner of the labor movement has debated reform. The AFL-CIO, to its credit, has listened to us. But in the end, they have not heard us. The language of reform has been adopted, but not the substance. Our principles have been watered down and papered over. And today, we have reached a point where our differences have become unresolvable. Workers wake up every day. They think about the difficult choices they face. Housing or health care, bus fare or breakfast. These should not be American choices. Our workers deserve better than that. The coalition's only mission is to make sure that they get it. A belief in fundamental reform is what unites our unions. We wish the AFL-CIO well. We want them to achieve their goals. We disagree with them about how to achieve our goals. It is clear at this convention we'll not adopt the strategies that we believe are what we need to win for working families. After all of our internal discussions and our own union processes, our unions have made decisions. Four of the Change to Win unions, the Teamsters, the United Food and Commercial Workers, Unite Here, and SEIU, will not participate in the AFL-CIO convention. None of the leaders of the Change to Win unions will serve in any elected capacity at the AFL-CIO. That's 20% of the Executive Council. Our leaders and organizing directors will begin implementing the Change to Win vision. Industry-wide organizing, coordinated bargaining, and political action aligned with aggressive organizing campaigns. We are going to walk our talk. We are going to get into the streets together. Hotel maids and Walmart clerks, child care providers and trash haulers, farm workers and carpenters, the workers who build the buildings and the workers who clean them. We now see an expanded, growing, vibrant labor movement. It's within our reach, and we will reach it. The debate is over. It's time to go to work, and that's what we're going to do. And now,
you were listening to Ann Berger, chair of the Change to Win Coalition, at the press conference announcing the boycott of the convention. We're in the process of bringing to you now Leon Lynch, who is the vice president for human affairs of the United Steelworkers of America and executive council member of the AFL-CIO. Good evening.
Good evening.
I'm actually sorry that you missed that bit of sound from Ann Berger. We wanted to kind of juxtapose and create a little bit of a spark. There is a natural spark there, certainly between the Federation proper and the Change to Win Coalition. Why don't we begin by, if I may, with SEIU and the Teamsters' disaffiliation from the Federation, will this kind of gaping budget hole in the AFL-CIO seriously cripple it? Indeed, in the past few months, the change to when unions have withheld their per capita contributions to the Federation, and they've not stated whether or how they would even pay their dues, not to mention collective action around and concerted pressure around Social Security or health care or trade policies such as CAFTA, etc.
Well, those are two big, good unions, and they did pay a considerable amount of per capita tax to the Federation. And, of course, it's going to mean that there's going to have to be some kind of economic juggling in order to actually make up for or to drop some programs that we were intending to engage in. However, the Executive Council today did pass a resolution to increase per capita tax, as well as the convention itself adopted a program to increase the per capita tax to try to at least cover some of the shortfall that will occur as a result of these two major unions getting out of the AFL-CIO.
In response to the Change to Win Coalition's demands over a period of last 6 months, the AFL-CIO has made a lot of changes with regard to rebates for organizing, changes on jurisdictional lines, changes on enforcement of no rating. How would these changes, is there any possibility that these changes would invigorate the Federation with regard to its organizing, which surely has been lacking within the last period of time?
Well, we really don't know the answer to that question until we've had some experiences with those changes. However, in an effort to try to reach an accord with the group that was intent on getting out, we really did make some changes at their suggestions, because there is a great need for solidarity and for unity. So we were doing everything we could to accommodate some of their good ideas, and they do have some good ideas. But I don't know if those are going to be all successful or how successful we will be with using those until we've had some experience with them. As you know, our opposition is toweringly great in trying to organize new unions in the United States. So we will, however, dedicate a lot more money to organizing, and we will get other international unions now to kick up more money into the organizing departments that they have. And some don't have organizing departments. We'll encourage them to put money into developing organizing departments. So that strategy, we think, can't help but provide some assistance in organizing more people.
Well, we're in the 50th anniversary, interestingly enough, of the AFL-CIO, and as major unions leave the ranks of the Federation, won't it hobble it significantly?
Of course, that's going to be a problem. And I won't deny that it won't hobble us in your term. But I think the main part of the AFL-CIO is still very much in full force and effect. And the ones that are out, I think, will continue to try to organize. I mean, these ideas they have, some of those are great ideas, and they're going to utilize those ideas. The fact that we will not be working from the same headquarters does not mean that we won't be working for the same goals and same principles. These are very principled unions, and they're very principled leaders for the most part. So I see no reason why that there should be any less organizing going on, even though they will be organizing from a different maybe federation if they establish one, and we'll be organizing from our own. I don't see our organization being any less, except the unions that we're now maintaining in the AFL-CIO will be putting a greater effort into trying to organize.
One of the new initiatives of this convention has been a detailed plan for diversity, for more inclusion of people of color, of women at all levels of the labor movement. Can you go into that?
Yeah, I think that's a good idea to increase the number of women and people of color on the Executive Council. That was accomplished today as well. 15 people were on the slate, and we all got elected today without opposition, 15 out of 43, which gives us, you know, a full one-third the total council now. So I think, you know, that the AFL-CIO leadership will, in fact, have a greater appearance like the membership of international unions. So I think that's a very positive thing, because minorities are quicker to organize into union than others, because there's a greater need by most minorities to be members of the union than the majorities in this country.
I just want to switch gears a little bit, because there's something critical that is before us, and that is that many may have heard that CAFTA is on the schedule today in the House of Representatives, and the Bush and Cheney administration are making a rare visit to the Capitol right now to lobby for remaining votes. So it's on. What is to be done at this juncture around CAFTA, and what's your position?
Well, of course, that demonstrates how desperately they are and how close the vote must be. If they are putting so-called big guns in there, the president and the vice president, to try to persuade congressmen to vote for CAFTA, which means it must, the count must also tell them that it's very close. We think it's relatively close as well, and the only thing that we can do, at least from here, of course, is to continue to call our congressmen and senators, especially congressmen now, and tell them how important we think it is to working people in the United States that we not allow these flawed trade agreements to be signed, which will do nothing to help the workers in the United States, and very little, if anything, to help the workers in the countries that will be getting that will be getting as members of that treaty. So I think that's a terrifically bad idea, and we're hopeful that it will fail tonight. But the fact that they have the president and the vice president of the United States is an indication that they, even in their count, think that they may lose it. It's very close.
One of the criticisms that we have had of both Change to Win and of the AFL-CIO is the failure to mobilize large numbers of people, large numbers of workers, around struggles like CAFTA, around struggles like the right to organize. Are there any plans to bring more people into the streets to really start mobilizing workers on any number of issues and organizing drives?
Yes, there are plans, but the plans really need to be implemented, and the implementation is yet to have happened. We have had some, for example, town hall meetings where we tried to familiarize people in various cities as the conditions that existed and the whole globalization that's taking place and the negative impact that it's having on people, especially workers in the United States. We have talked all the time about and having to have needing an industrial policy, having lost 3 million industrial jobs since 1998. We've talked incessantly about it, but maybe not to a large enough group. And I think what we need to do, and we're planning to do, is to activate more of our members at the local level, at the central bodies and state bodies, down where we say the rubber hits the road, because they actually live in the communities where a lot of the people that we need to influence will be picking up information and directions from them. And so we're activating, we have a very good program, comprehensive program, for the state federations and the central bodies, which we hope to implement very soon.
Well, Leon Lynch, I remember that many people were extremely enthusiastic when they saw the steelworkers marching along with the Turtles during what became known as the Battle of Seattle, the joining together of the environmental movement against the various world trade policies, which inure only negatively to the rank and file and to impoverished people throughout the world. There seems, again, to be a desperate need. I still have that fantasy of the, yes, that million worker march where people come out, not just symbolic demonstrations around Social Security or single-payer health system, but where they really come out in full regalia and say, we are here in our strength. What's going to do that? Why such timidity to really bring the masses forward?
Well, I think, you know, we need to plan, and you're right, we need to plan things like we used to have years ago. We used to call them solidarity marches, solidarity demonstrations in Washington, D.C., or activate a plan where we have demonstrations in every major city in the country the same day by our state bodies and our central bodies and the international unions in those cities. And that needs to come back into the fold. And we expect some of that to be coming out very soon, because it's clear that when people understand our position, the masses of people that live in the community support us. The environmentalists, you know, the people that are concerned about energy, the progressives, people that work in the universities, you know, these people are very, very committed to making sure that America is a good place for their followers, you know, their kids and their grandkids and so forth. So it's, I think, important for us to engage in such a program of trying to develop a structures where we will be communicating with the masses and listen to them as well, not just a one-way street, because their issues are our issues as well.
We've been speaking with Leon Lynch, Vice President for Human Affairs of the United Steelworkers of America and Executive Council Member of the AFL-CIO. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall the state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. This was added to the Constitution in 1868 to protect freed slaves. However, the 1886 Santa Clara decision made corporations persons with constitutional protections under the 14th Amendment. Supreme Court Justice Hugo Black pointed out that of the cases in this court in which the 14th Amendment was applied, during the first 50 years after its adoption, less than one half of 1%.
This is a Pacifica Radio Network special labor coverage to your local community radio station of the blockbuster event surrounding the AFL-CIO at its 25th Constitutional Convention in Chicago. This report is coming to you from the studio of WBAI Radio in New York and is produced by Building Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Mimi Rosenberg with Ken Nash on assignment in Chicago.
Challenge the corporate power in its final hour. Bring light, assert the people's rights. Challenge the corporate power in its final hour. The hour of that white collar puppets, the blue collar.
Now, Ken Nash interviews U.S. Labor Against the War co-convener Gene Brushkin, who mobilized for a resolution by the AFL-CIO to end the U.S. occupation in Iraq. Let's find out the results.
I'm outside the AFL-CIO Convention Hall with Gene Brushkin, co-convener of U.S. Labor Against the War, and we're talking about the historic resolution that the AFL-CIO passed to end the war and occupation of Iraq. Now, I had understood that the AFL-CIO was trying to delay the resolution so it would only come up toward the end of the conference on Thursday, and then it was pushed forward to yesterday.
The decision that was made this weekend at the Resolutions Committee of the AFL was that the resolution would read on the issue of withdrawal that they would bring the troops home as quickly as possible, number one, and number two, that the resolution would be discussed on Thursday morning, which is the end of the convention. And it's very common, and certainly this week be very likely, that you'll have an empty room. So we thought that that was inappropriate.
So what happened?
We made our opinion known to the council, and we asked those people who had an interest in seeing these resolutions properly discussed to communicate to Jerry McEntee and others our opinion. And we held a forum on Monday night that between 100 and 150 people attended with the Iraqis to discuss the occupation and the U.S. labor against the war, and importantly to decide how to make sure that this situation was corrected. As a result of that meeting, a message got to the executive council. They discussed it. They decided that they would accept the word rapidly, bring the troops home rapidly instead of as soon as possible, and that they would bring it up yesterday for a full debate. So we were pleased, and that's what happened.
And everybody's going to get out their dictionaries at this point, because the question then becomes, what is the definition of rapidly? Some people are thinking that this is not as good as the resolution that was before, which said immediate pullout.
U.S. law, the resolutions are sort of base resolutions called for immediate withdrawal. I think that, you know, the general feeling was, of all the people who spoke, was like, get them out of there. get the people home, get the troops home, end the occupation. This is what Jesse Jackson said in the morning, bring the troops home, bring the troops home, and bring the troops home. And that was the tenor of the entire discussion. And our sense is we want them home fast. The question of immediate, in a way, although that's the word we have suggested in general, it's a word game because immediate means, in 5 minutes. So we want them home, we want them home fast, and we want an end to the occupation. That was the sense. In fact, in the discussion on the floor, some of the people supporting the resolution said that, this is to bring them home immediately.
The chair, Leo Garrod from the Steelworkers, what was his interpretation?
Leo started off by saying that there were 18 resolutions submitted from all over the country calling for an end to the occupation and bringing the troops home, and that there was widespread sentiment, and that's why it was coming to the floor. And what was interesting is that lined up at the mics, at every one of the four mics, were long lines of people standing up and denouncing the occupation and calling home for the removal of the U.S. troops. So I think the message was very clear that this is not something in Bush's discretion, that will set a date in a calendar some other time. We want them home.
Do you think the FLCIO is going to really push this now, or are they going to sit on their hands?
Well, my guess is that, like a lot of other resolutions, particularly on these kind of issues, they can be seen symbolically by the Federation. And in fact, they can often be symbolic. But first of all, the symbolism is extremely important because it puts the AFL-CIO on record. It is also important because for those thousands and thousands of activists around the country, it gives them an opportunity to go to their local and state bodies and to their organization and say, we've got to be against this war and be out there publicly, because even at the highest levels of the labor movement, they've condemned the wars based on lies and they called for bringing the troops home. So it, for the people out in the field who are really the ones that bring people into the streets, this opens a lot of doors, and we intend to make sure that this resolution is seen on the streets and in the union halls.
There's another part of the resolution that causes a lot of people concern about the international community training security forces in Iraq.
The resolution was not the U.S. Labor Against the War resolution. It was a resolution of the Executive Council. And in that resolution were support for Iraqi labor rights, were a demand that foreign debts to Saddam Hussein be forgiven, were denouncing the Bush war as based on lies and deception. And we're calling for solidarity with Iraqi trade unionists. We agreed with all that stuff. There were things in there, in supporting the troops, demanding full rights for veterans, rights and benefits, supporting our own members and vets when they come home. There's a lot of stuff we agreed in. There were things in there that U.S. Labor and the War didn't agree with, and you don't get 100%. But what we decided is that rather than raise 11 issues that in a way were peripheral, we wanted to go to the one essential issue, which is, when are the troops coming home? And they wanted to say as quickly as possible. And clearly, as soon as you put the word as possible in there, you are giving the Bush administration the decision on what is possible. We based it on the resolution coming out of Philadelphia, which with broad support in the Labor Council among the construction trades, veterans, and a range of unions, where they call for a rapid withdrawal. So we figured that was a huge step in the right direction, and we got it through.
Do you think that the split in the AFL-CIO is causing them to be a bit more responsive to the delegates, to the membership?
Well, they're certainly vulnerable at the moment at this point for the AFL-CIO, and we made it clear from our perspective that if we're trying to build and make changes in the labor movement, certainly having democratic debate and being responsive to the perspectives of such a wide range of your membership is absolutely crucial. And I think to their credit, they heard it and they responded to it. But I think it was also to the credit of that of all the folks all over the country and many of their representatives are here that they made sure their voices were heard.
What's the next step?
We have already been making sure that everyone all over the world knows that this is the case. And that we believe that September 24th is a crucial date, and that unions should have buses out there, that this has to be a situation where unions are seen on the street with their members, with their union banners, marching in the front of this march along with Iraqi vets and military families. So we're going to encourage that. We're going to try and get official buy-in.
So to encourage people to become involved through their labor unions in the end to the war in Iraq, what should people do? How do people find more information?
Well, stay tuned to the U.S. Law website. We already have some flyers up there that you can use as a basis to, you know, generate your own flyers. It's www.uslaboragainstwar.org.
Thank you so much. I've been talking with Gene Breshkin, co-convener of U.S. Labor Against the War.
Joining us now is Jose La Luz, AFL-CIO organizer working on the Puerto Rico contract campaign. And I think you're actually right down the hallway from Ken Nash. Hi, Jose. How are you?
Hi, how are you?
Jose, you're an organizer. You've been a successful organizer for a number of years. Do you see anything in the Change to Win strategy, their emphasis on organizing core workers, increased funding for organizing, and now they're saying that they're going to be increased cooperation between the members of the Change to Win coalition. Is that going to be able to produce results?
Well, you know, it is certainly, you know, my wish and that of many other people who do this for a living that they will succeed in moving forward a program that will expand organizing significantly in a large scale, organizing of the kind that they proclaim it's necessary in order to build the power for workers. But the fact of the matter is that the coalition has some unions that have yet to prove, you know, that they have the capacity to conduct this kind of large-scale organizing campaigns. The Teamsters and the food and commercial workers haven't necessarily become known as very successful organizing unions. The SEIU and Unite, you know, is certainly a different story, but it is my hope and certainly that of many other folks that they will succeed and perhaps they can create, you know, a situation where folks in the unions that have remained within the federation would choose to emulate, you know, their efforts and would choose to put far more resources into organizing.
Well, given the changes that the AFL-CIO says it's making, you know, again, looking at the due structure and the rebate, does that really make a difference in unionization from your perspective? Where is the voice of the rank and file? And isn't that the critical element?
Well, frankly, you know, this so-called debate has become, if anything, a missed opportunity to engage thousands of men and women who are in fact the ones that could make this happen, this necessary change that needs to take place at the very local level. And it is unfortunate that the men, mostly men, that lead these unions did not see fit to develop an approach that would have engaged, you know, men and women in a serious discussion, in a serious conversation about the condition of organized labor in this country and the need to develop far-reaching strategies. I think that if this had been the case in South Africa with COSATU, the confederation there, or in Brazil with the CUT, it may have been different in terms of this level of engagement that would have raised the awareness that there are serious challenges facing organized labor, but that hasn't been the case. I mean, for it is a fact that most rank-and-file members are not fully aware of the implications of this so-called debate, simply because they have not been invited to participate in the conversation, you know. And they are the ones that would make this fundamental, you know, shift happen as it happened, you know, back in the 1930s, the kind of organizing that took place in communities of immigrants that transformed the labor movement were, in fact, driven by hundreds of men and women who, you know, saw the need to take ownership of this process of building a different kind of labor organization, such as was the case, you know, with the CIO, for instance. But that, I'm afraid, is not the case today.
Do you think it's a possibility that the challenge by the Change to Win coalition would basically give the AFL-CIO a kick in the behind? Are you hearing anything from other people within the AFL-CIO that they do need to involve the workers more, that they do need to have more mass mobilizations, they do need to, in a sense, change to win?
There are a number of you know, men and women in different unions who are seriously committed to doing the kinds of changes that are necessary within the unions in order to organize, you know, in a larger scale and from the bottom up. But unfortunately, these are not the men and women who make the policies and make the decisions in their unions. I mean, it is a fact that for the most part, many of the men that lead these institutions are people who have not necessarily engaged in these kinds of, you know, bottom-up, you know, struggles, with some exceptions, perhaps. This is not the generation of men and, to some extent, women that built many of these unions several decades ago. And I think that there is an opportunity to, as I said, emulate, you know, the changes that perhaps may be contemplated in you know, the different unions that make up this coalition. That is sincerely my hope. I think that the organization of immigrants is absolutely critical and essential in terms of turning things around. But in order to do that, they need to go beyond the traditional bargaining unit type of, you know, organizing. Whether it's using the labor board or, as has become the case now, working beyond and outside, you know, the scope of the labor board by leveraging, you know, contractual relationships and corporate pressure campaigns that result in neutrality agreements and card check agreements, that still, you know, doesn't engage the hundreds of thousands of people, particularly immigrants, that will in fact transform, you know, this movement substantially and significantly. But it is my hope that, you know, some of these unions that are really committed and serious will raise, you know, the stakes in terms of, you know, what are some of the things that need to be done.
Well, Jose La Luz, we have about 30 seconds for you to speak about the contract campaign with public employees in Puerto Rico.
We'll engage in a campaign now. The governor has announced massive layoffs, perhaps as many as 14,000. The leaders who are here at the convention, in fact, are going back to the island this evening because, you know, there is a huge fight after we organize 100,000 plus men and women in public service. All of this is threatened by the fiscal crisis in the island, so I'm going to be spending a lot of time assisting with that.
Well, we will speak to you more in the future, and we have been speaking with Jose La Luz, AFL-CIO organizer, working on the Puerto Rico contract campaign.
Thank you so much.
The Reverend Jesse Jackson, who spoke at the convention, hits the right notes.
You must debate and you must change, but you must be able to differ and still come together. The inter-squad struggle must not leave so much blood on the field that you cannot compete in the interleague games. This fight is not us versus us, it's us versus them, and them is coming at us real hard. You must learn to fight internally, but coalesce externally against those who would destroy both sides of internal struggles. We who are supporters of the House of Labor must choose reconciliation and not just choose sides. We're now into radical introspection that could lead to disintegration of our strength. Now we must do a difficult thing and agree to disagree and still negotiate operational unity within our own family. Everyone who cares about progressive reform in America, civil rights, women's rights, the environment, workers' rights, decent wages, good education, affordable health care, secure retirements, a strong America has a stake in labor growing stronger, not weaker, bolder, and not broken. Change is not easy. Change requires debate. Debate causes friction. Friction causes sparks. Those sparks can light the way if they do not burn the house down. Strong leadership is vital now. For the pressure won't stop until we release new energy to challenge it. We need a vision that makes room for all of us. It must be accompanied by a will to fight. Let us fight about the best way to organize and unite around a common external agenda. Empower workers and hold corporations accountable. Stop CAFTA and start making sense in our trade policy. That's our struggle. Reinvest in America and put America back to work. Invest in people, not tax cuts for the few. Strengthen Social Security and stop the effort to dismantle it. We must unite to stop this threat to America's most successful social program, Social Security. What is our vision that unites us? Affordable health care for all. An education of equal high quality for all. Good job with good wages. And lift the poor by raising the minimum wage. Honor the soldiers and bring them home. And bring them home with a job when they get home. And health insurance when they get home. And a decent house when they get home. current labor law puts workers at risk. Progressives of all stripes should join unified labor in demanding passage of the Employee Choice Act now. We must show immediately that we will continue to build through the pressure and the heat. Even as we fight internally, we will coalesce against our enemies externally. The entire Congress is up for re-election next year. We must not let our internal fights weaken our cooperation in these vital external fights. We need a new Congress. We must fight and keep our eyes on the real prize. We must make a strategic adjustment. Today, I must say I am not pleased with Democrats, and I am not scared of Republicans. We must frame a new partnership and not be a pawn in the struggle for our dignity and identity. Republicans strongly attack us. Democrats offer a weak defense with fuzzy ideology. Under their watch, we've borne the brunt of NAFTA and now CAFTA and three strikes. We must go on the offensive. We must open up the process. We must negotiate a new deal with the Democratic Party and change the options of the radical right. We must use litigation, legislation, state referenda, and ballot initiatives and demonstrations. We've joined the party, but the party must join our movement for fundamental change. We must change the political environment by moving the earth with massive ground action. The labor struggles in the 30s were not led by either party. It was an independent driven by workers' real needs, not party needs. The 55 bus boycott against segregation was independent. We wrote the Voting Rights Act in blood. It was co-signed in ink. When we act, we make the whole nation move. The party must join our struggle for liberation. We cannot join theirs for status quo adjustment, tinkering, and managing crisis. Our future is not born with either party, but rather to create enough legitimate people's action for both parties follow us. Our drive is not to project and protect milk toast Democrats. We must have our own street heat action and fight for health care and jobs and right to organize. They must follow us. We cannot follow them because they ain't going nowhere. We need to organize. We need to march. We need to fight back. This land is our land. We must build an independent political struggle to define priorities and behavior of both parties. Rise up today, fight through our tears, overcome our pain, choose reconciliation over polarization. Rise up today. We must turn to each other, not on each other. Reach out and create a real one big tent struggle. I'm glad to be with those who are here today. I reach out for those who are not here. We all belong under one big tent, fighting for jobs and justice and health care and peace. Keep hope alive. Health care. Right to organize. Livable wage. Open up trade unions. End the war. Decent housing. A new Congress. And a legitimate president.
You've been listening to Jesse Jackson, who spoke at the convention and hit the right notes. And you've been listening to Pacifica Radio Network's special labor coverage of the AFL-CIO's 25th Constitutional Convention in Chicago. This program was produced at the studio of WBAI Radio in New York by Building Bridges, your Community and Labor Report reporters, Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash in Chicago.